Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Cullen Murphy. He's a writer, an editor at large at Vanity Fair, and we're talking about his new book, Cartoon County, My Father and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. Cullen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, great to be with you, Mark.
This is a wonderful memoir. I think anybody who remembers the Sunday comic section has to read this book. It's about your father, John Cullen Murphy, artist, illustrator, and cartoonist, but it's also the whole area you lived in. Where was that?
It was in Fairfield County, Connecticut, mainly. And there was kind of a fluke of history that resulted in maybe 100 cartoonists, illustrators, gag cartoonists, comic strip cartoonists, all living in this general area. Now, you know, there were cartoonists in Manhattan, lots of them, but there was this vast group that was out in Connecticut. And the fluke of history was, first of all, you had to be near New York if you were a cartoonist in, let's say, the 40s, 50s, 60s, because there was no internet, there weren't fax machines, and you frequently had to go into New York to talk to the syndicates and the people who were buying your stuff. So that was one thing, and Connecticut was still close to New York City. You could take the train. The second thing was Connecticut had no income tax, so you could live in Connecticut, be 45 minutes away from Manhattan, and you had a tax holiday. So a lot of people, especially those who were just starting families, moved out to Connecticut. And at the time, it was sort of a frontier. Nowadays, places like Greenwich are, who can afford Greenwich? But back then, it was, underpopulated. There were still a lot of farms. Houses were cheap. So a lot of cartoonists moved out there for that reason. And a few cartoonists and artists and illustrators had moved out earlier, so there was already a nucleus there to build around. So by the time I came along in the 50s, my father was there, my mother was there, and there were probably another 100 cartoonists, and they created kind of a social circle for themselves.
There's a map in this book that was done by an aerial map done by Mort Walker and Jerry Dumas of all the cartoonists that lived in this area. And it's mind-boggling. Like, you grew up and you were used to it. But to look at it from this distance, it seems wild that all these cartoonists are sort of living in this one area. Besides your father, who, and we'll talk about what he drew in just a second, there were people like Dick Brown, who did High and Lois, Hagar the Horrible, Ernie Bushmiller, who did Nancy, Chuck Saxon, one of the great New Yorker cartoonists, and the list just went on. I mean, it's just incredible. So you grew up thinking it was nothing to have your father stay home from work and work at home.
Well, that's right. Now, that map that you're referring to, one of the things that is noteworthy about it is that Mort Walker, who drew the map with Jerry Dumas, and Mort was responsible for a lot of comic strips. First Beetle Bailey,
right,
and High and Lois.
Oh, yeah.
And Boner's Ark. But he couldn't fit them all in. So, you're looking at maybe a third of the cartoonists and gag cartoonists who were there. But yes, it was, when I was growing up, the idea that you went home from school and your dad was there, quote unquote, working, was second nature. My childhood was not one where a parent got on the train and went to New York and did something in finance or advertising or business of some other kind, which is what you think of when you think of a place like Fairfield County nowadays. But for me and for other children of cartoonists, it wasn't like that at all. So we were living in this, even though we didn't know it, in a strange, sort of Brigadoon-like world that was actually had nothing to do with the rest of the world. And I'm sure that shaped us in ways that we can't really put our finger on.
There's some amazing memories recounted in this book about your father's studio. First of all, you were able to just walk in all the time into your father's studio while he was working. And as a matter of fact, he often used you in photography. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, the studio was, it was open territory. Everybody, when my brothers and sisters and I got home from school, we always made a beeline for the studio just to say hello. And because something interesting was always happening, he'd be drawing something fun, or he'd stop and draw something for you. And there's generally an old movie on the TV set. You know, it didn't really look like working in any. Conventional sense. And then there were these photographs. Now, my father bought a Polaroid camera in the late 40s, right when they came out. And the reason he did this was so that he could take pictures of himself posing. You know, when you think about it, a comic strip, especially one of the dramatic ones,
right?
The adventure strips, Flash Gordon or Rip Kirby, or Secret Agent X9, much less Tarzan or Prince Valiant. There are a lot of separate scenes in there, and there are lots of figures that are being drawn, and they're doing all kinds of things. You know, they're riding horses, or leaping out of spaceships, or having sword fights, and so you could just draw this stuff from your knowledge of anatomy and so on. But it was much easier to take pictures of yourself doing things. And so my father got into the habit of taking pictures of himself. And sometimes he used one of those pneumatic plungers. But when kids were home, he would dragoon us into taking pictures of him. And this generally involved him dressing up in some sort of strange costume, sometimes as a woman, and doing things with swords or broomsticks or trash can lids, and looking ridiculous, frankly. Although it didn't seem all that, again, it didn't seem all that odd at the time. Standing on the train platform with a briefcase looked fairly ridiculous to me, whereas my father wearing a wig and holding a trash can lid and pretending to fight a dragon was just like a normal afternoon. And he would take, in the course of a week, it would take 30 or 40 of these pictures. And, frequently I'd be there on a ladder or something taking the pictures of him. And he saved them all. That's the odd thing. I don't recall that he ever went back and used any of the old ones because it was just too hard to find. Once you'd taken several thousand of these pictures, how do you go back and find the guy on horseback, drinking from a canteen from among all those? You can't. You just take the picture again. So as a result, we have thousands of these pictures spanning 50 years. And I keep wondering, is there any photo archive in America that's comparable to this?
Well, let's talk about your father's work, first of all. The great thing is he saved all his drawings he did as a kid, and those are reproduced in this book too, some of them. He had talent early on, and it's amazing to look at his artwork that he did during World War II, and many of these artists were in World War II. He did some incredible realistic and also some more caricature work during World War II of life in the army. I mean, it was, he even drew General MacArthur.
I was astonished to go back and look at his full body of work.
Jeez.
Over time. He was a superb artist, and some of the paintings and drawings that he did, quite apart from the two comic strips he did, are really glorious.
They really are. They're really amazing.
There's a huge stash of them at Brown University, which has a big military collection. But going through his papers, as you will have seen, there are drawings from when he's 5 years old. He really did save everything. you know, almost as if he figured, you know, I'm gonna be something someday, so I better start saving that history test from third grade.
I got that feeling when I saw those early drawings, which were actually, some of them were really good from a very young age. But, you know, I want to get back to this military work because, you know, people don't see this enough. I mean, there was a whole series of drawings of the Women's Army Corps, which was like a real sort of insight into what day-to-day life was like. And so he gets out of the war, and he's known predominantly for two very big strips, Big Ben Bolt and then Prince Valiant. We'll talk about Big Ben Bolt first. What's the plot of that for people who are too young to remember?
So you have to cast your mind back a little bit to a time when prize fighting was a bigger deal in America than it is right now. You know, nowadays, the big fights will get some publicity, but the other fights don't have much of a public presence. It's not like the way it used to be. But when you go back 60 or 70 years, it was very different, and you had two strips, actually, that were built around prize fighting. One of them was Joe Palooka, which was more cartoonish strip, and the other one was Big Ben Bolt, which was a very realistic strip. And Ben Bolt was, you know, when you're casting around for a character, you've got to play around with it a little bit, and this was a Ivy League-educated prize fighter and heavyweight champion. We haven't had too many of those in history, but you got to come up with a with an idea. And he was he lived in Boston. He had an aunt and uncle who were kind of doddering and funny and caricatures of Boston Brahmin types who lived on Beacon Hill. So pretty unusual background for a prize fighter. And of course, as he got older, he left the ring and became a journalist and a quasi detective. So it was always an adventure story, punctuated with prize fighting. And of course, the odd thing about the prize fighting strip was the censorship rules of the syndicates, which wouldn't allow you to show male nipples. So here you have a prize fighter who is, you know, bare-chested, of course, during fights, and who has no nipples.
He ended up getting killed off in the end.
Ben Bolt was ultimately killed off, and it was after my father had given up that strip and started doing Prince Valiant.
Now,
I don't know who was writing it at the time, but there, in order to end the strip, Ben Bolt was actually killed off. He was assassinated while accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. This is something I hadn't known. My father had never known it because people were so shocked that a strip would end this way that most newspapers didn't show it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Cullen Murphy. He's a writer, editor-at-large at Vanity Fair, and we're talking about his wonderful new book, a wonderful memoir, Cartoon County, My Father and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. Let's talk about your father's work in Prince Valiant. Now, Prince Valiant, one of my favorite strips. I mean, anybody who remembers the Sunday sections, and by the way, you have an amazing thing in this book where you essentially go page by page through the great Sunday sections, and then you finally get to this strip, Prince Valiant, and it was just wonderful if you were a young person reading this. Now, Prince Valiant was originally drawn by Hal Foster, right?
Yes. Hal Foster created the strip in 1937, and it was immediately successful. And as you were pointing out, Mark, it ran on an entire newspaper page.
Oh man, I love that.
it was so beautiful. And we're not talking about the modern reduced size newspaper.
No.
We're talking about
the big fat juicy page,
big broadsheet.
Yeah,
almost 2 feet by 3 feet in size. You know, a little bit smaller than that, but it gives you the idea. So so big that a kid could not actually comfortably read the newspapers in a chair. You know, you had to put them down on the floor to read them. And but Prince Valiant was the most extraordinary piece of illustration in the Sunday papers week after week. And Hal did it up through around 69 or 70. And then he was of course getting older. He had some arthritis. He wanted to give up the drawing of the strip. And so he chose my father to do it. So my father did it for basically the next 30 plus years. And then eventually, after 7 or 8 years, Hal gave up the writing as well, and I took over the writing, and I worked with my father for about 25 years on the strip.
What a great memory. What an amazing experience to have had.
The problem was that he could draw a lot faster than I could write.
And you know what? If anybody remembers Prince Valiant, I almost find that hard to believe because the drawings are so detailed. And every kid who ever saw Prince Valiant at that time, you just fell in love with it. There was action. It looked great. It was fantastic. It was just, after going through, and I loved the other comics, the gag comics and stuff like that, like High and Lois and all that other stuff, the Disney stuff. But when you got to that, man, that was the meat and potatoes. That was the heart of the thing that you waited for. You sort of left it for the end and savored it until you get to there. And it was just great to enjoy. You have a lot of information in this about what it was like for these comic artists to make a living. And there's some interesting things I never knew before. For instance, there's something you called Look Day. What was that?
Look Day was, it was actually 2 days, depending on where you're going. But Look Day was the day when gag cartoonists came into New York City and tried to sell their gag cartoons to various magazines. Now, nowadays, you can thumb through a lot of magazines on the magazine rack and not find many that publish gag cartoons. But 50 years ago, there were a lot of magazines that did it. It was a mainstay. And today, The New Yorker is the one that's best known.
Right.
But decades ago, you would have had 20, 25 magazines that bought gag cartoons. So on Look Day, the cartoonists would come in from Connecticut or wherever else they were, or if they lived in Manhattan, they were already there, and they would go around to all the magazines with their rough sketches of their gags. And they would start, of course, with the magazines that paid the most, and then the next stop would be the number two, and they'd go all the way through the list of magazines, hoping that they would sell at least a few of these gag cartoons during the course of their visit. And of course it was a great time for socializing. They would meet for lunch, they would meet for dinner, they would stagger home on the train. This was a time when the trains still had bar cars on them, if you remember that. But it was a wonderful convivial time, and it was usually Wednesdays. The New Yorker jumped the gun and had its Look Day for its preferred clients on Tuesday, but most of them did it on Wednesday.
Now, you mentioned the word syndication, and that's one of those words that everybody has heard a lot who remembers the comics, but they don't really know what it means. What did syndication mean for the artists?
Essentially, syndication is a distribution mechanism. So, let's say you're a cartoonist. You've got a great idea for a comic strip. Well, it can be the best idea that anybody has ever thought of, but if it's just on your drawing board or you're showing it around to a few friends, it doesn't do much good, and it definitely doesn't earn a living. So the syndicates grew out of newspapers for the most part, and they had they were in existence probably by the turn of the 20th century, and at first, what they were was a way of distributing, features that the big newspapers like the Hearst chain, distributing those features nationwide to all of the newspapers that were part of their system, and it could be any number of things, not just comic strips. as time went on, the kinds of material that fed into the syndication system became more diverse, and comic strip artists and gag cartoonists would make deals with the syndicate. You know, if the syndicate happened to like a particular comic strip, they would take it on and say, yeah, go ahead, do this. We'll distribute it for you. We're going to take a cut of the profits, and you can have the rest. So that's a way in which the cartoonists were able to get their work distributed. Yeah, needless to say, the syndicates have a great deal of power, and they had a life and death say over the the fate of cartoon strips. But it was it's a necessary mechanism in order to get comic strips around the country.
Now, for people like your father who were in syndication, that means you had to meet a deadline. How was the work transferred from your home to where it needed to go?
People will remember that there was once such a thing as U.S. mail, and it was reliable. So every week or so, actually it was about twice a week, once for the Sundays and once for the dailies, he would package up the strips and send them off to New York. It was not foolproof.
Okay.
And, there are many ways in which the system could go awry. One of them was simply, you're running late, and the mail is not going to help you. This was one of the reasons why it was necessary to be close to New York, because from time to time you had to hop on the train and bring the work in yourself. I was once, more than once, but deputized to bring the strip in on behalf of my father. You know, he was so far behind that he couldn't even take the time to bring the strip in, physically himself. And I remember once when I was, must have been 11, just being put on the train, and I had the strip was wrapped in brown paper. It was surrounded by string. The string was then tied to my belt.
Wow.
And I got on the train, and my father talked to the conductor and said, make sure he gets off. And I got off at Grand Central, and then I was met at Grand Central by someone from King Features Syndicate, who then took the strip from me and put me back on the train.
Oh, wow. There's so many amazing memories in this book, and one of them that I just have to mention, because as a person who's drawn a lot myself, every cartoonist bore a hand callus on the distal interphalangeal joint of the middle finger. And only somebody who knows, who has to draw a lot, especially on deadline, knows what that means. I have had that callus.
It was a very distinctive feature, and it never quite got completely clean.
Nope.
Because
I'm looking at mine now.
The ink was it had become part of his skin in a way. When he was older, when I would shake his hand, I could always feel it. And there's something else that that's kind of related to that, and that is his drawing board, which I have in my office. In fact, I'm looking at it right now as we speak. And along the bottom, there's a crossbar that's just put there, like a lot of tables have, to reinforce the sides, and he would rest his right foot on that crossbar, and the crossbar itself has a callus in it where his foot rested for more than 50 years, and it's just been worn away in a gentle U. So I think of the two things together, the callus on his finger and then this declivity on the crossbar.
We're almost completely out of time, and we could be talking about this book for so much more. But you talk about the kind of anonymous celebrity that your father had. Everybody everybody knew the comic strips, but nobody would recognize the artist.
That's right. The phrase anonymous celebrity is one that that Brian Walker came up with. Brian is the son of Mort Walker, and he was struck by the phenomenon that you've just put your finger on, which is, you know, around the world, everybody knows Snoopy. Everybody yep. knows Beetle Bailey or Prince Valiant. Nobody has a clue who the people are who created these things.
I know.
And, you know, you could run into them, you know, on a train or the supermarket, and, you know, unlike every other form, kind of celebrity, you would just say, excuse me, and walk on by. They were unremarkable the way they looked. You know, they could be handsome or schlubby. They could, you know, look like a pharmacist, or they could look like the village idiot. But what they didn't look like was somebody that you recognized, because nobody had any idea who these people actually were in their, you know, their so-called real lives.
And with that, we're going to end. And one of the great things is this book corrects that. My guest tonight is Cullen Murphy. He's a writer, editor-at-large at Vanity Fair, and we've been talking about his new book. It's a wonderful memoir, Cartoon County, My Father and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. Cullen, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.